wonder as we might, we can't imagine what it was like to meet Jesus of Nazareth during his days on earth. It's said that no life that ever encountered him left the same. They were changed in some way. Now, that doesn't mean everybody believed in him. In fact, most people did not. But everyone felt the impact of his words, his works, and his presence. Every now and then, I kind of daydream a little bit and think, wouldn't it be great to be able to go back in time? I would love time travel. And honestly, I wouldn't think so much of going ahead. I'd love to go back. And I'd love to go back to the time of Jesus. Wouldn't it be wonderful? Just to be that proverbial fly on the wall. Just somebody in the background. Maybe nobody else even knew you were there, but you could see and you could hear. And know what he looked like. Know what his voice sounded like. And experience his power. We read of one such person in the latter part of John chapter 4, the passage that was read for us earlier. We begin in verses 43 and through 45. After 2 days, he left for Galilee. That after 2 days refers to his time in Samaria. A few weeks back, we looked at his encounter with the woman at the well there in Samaria. And after 2 days staying there, he continued his journey from Judea up to Galilee. Now, Jesus himself had pointed out that a prophet has no honor in his country. Now, this seems out of place in this passage as we're reading, but I believe this is John's hinting at what happened when Jesus revealed himself in the synagogue of his hometown of Nazareth. And again, we covered that a few weeks ago. Remember, he came in as the hometown hero, the hometown boy that made good. And they had great expectations for him. But when he sat down and after reading the passage from Isaiah, that the Lord was going to send a promised one to set his people free, he sat down and just said very simply, "Today, Scripture is being fulfilled in your hearing." Which was another way of saying, "Here I am, folks. I'm the one that's talking about." And the people didn't like that. In fact, they ran him out on a rail. They wanted to do more than that. They wanted to run him over the cliff and stone him to death. But he stopped that from happening. I think this is John's little hint of what's recorded in the other Gospels. When he arrived in Galilee, the Galileans welcomed him. Now, that sounds like a contradiction. But as we're going to see, this welcome was really kind of a rejection. Because they weren't really so much interested in him, they were interested in his miracles. See, they heard what had happened down in Jerusalem during the time of the Passover. Some of them had actually been there. They saw these powerful signs that he was doing. They saw and they heard him speak and the words that he used. And they were excited. They thought, "Hey, we're going to get more of the same. Hey, folks, there's a great show playing out in town. Jesus of Nazareth is here. Let's go see what he's going to do next." That was the welcome that he received. What we see here are people not welcoming a Messiah who could save them, but looking for a miracle worker to amaze them. And sadly, you still see people like that today. Kyle Eidelman writes in his book, Not a Fan, and if you haven't read that book, I would highly recommend it. "It may seem that there are many followers of Jesus, but if they were honestly to define the relationship they have with him, I'm not sure it would be accurate to describe them as followers. It seems to me that there's a more suitable word to describe them. They are not followers of Jesus, they are fans of Jesus." Here's the most basic definition of a fan in the dictionary: an enthusiastic admirer. It's the guy that goes to the football game with no shirt on and painted letter on his chest. He sits in the stands and he cheers for his team. He's got a signed jersey hanging on his wall back at home and multiple bumper stickers on the back of his car. He even wears ties with the team's logo. But he's never in the game. He never breaks a sweat or takes a hard hit in the open field. Oh, he knows all about the players. He can rattle off their latest stats, but he doesn't know any of the players. He yells and cheers, but nothing is really required of him. There's no sacrifice he has to make. And truth is, as excited as he seems, if the team he's cheering for starts to let him down and has a few off seasons, his passion will wane pretty quickly. After several losing seasons, you can expect him to jump off the fan wagon and begin cheering for some other team. He is an enthusiastic admirer. It's the woman who never misses the celebrity news shows. She always picks up the latest People magazine. She's a huge fan of some actress who's in the latest Hollywood sensation. And this woman not only knows every movie this actress has been in, she knows what high school she went to. She knows her birthday. She knows the name of her first boyfriend. She even knows what this actress's real hair color is, something the actress herself is no longer certain of. She knows everything about her there is to know, but she doesn't know her. She's a huge fan, but she's just a fan. She's an enthusiastic admirer. And I think Jesus has a lot of fans these days. Fans who cheer for him when things are going well, but who walk away when it's a difficult season. Fans who sit safely in the stands cheering, but they know nothing of the sacrifice and the pain of the field. Fans of Jesus know all about him, but they don't really know him. Now, it may have appeared to the casual onlooker that Jesus had a lot of followers there in Galilee, but a closer inspection would reveal that many of them were merely fans. They were fascinated by Jesus' works and his words, but did they really have faith? And that question, faith or fascination, is zeroed in on one person in this text. Verse 46 and 47 picks up the story. Once more, Jesus visited Cana in Galilee, where he had turned the water into wine. There was a certain royal official whose son lay sick in Capernaum. When this man heard that Jesus had arrived in Galilee from Judea, he went to him and begged him to come and heal his son, who was close to death. We see Jesus coming back to the little village of Cana in Galilee, the site of his first miracle. You might wonder, why did he go back there? And we're not really told. Maybe he wanted to cultivate the seed he had planted at the time of that first miracle. Or maybe he wanted to see if that miraculous sign really produced any faith or just fascination. We're not sure. But into this scene comes in a certain royal official. The phrase translates a Greek word that literally means a king's man. And in this setting, he was probably a member of the court of Herod Antipas, who was technically a tetrarch in Galilee, but he was called king by a lot of the people. That's because his father, King Herod the Great, was known by that title. Now, this man locates Jesus in Cana, but his son is sick in Capernaum. Now, that's about 18 miles away. You think, 18 miles, that's not bad. 15, 20 minutes, depending on the highway, you can be there. Well, remember, we're talking ancient culture. This would have been about a six-hour walk or 2 hours by chariot. And since this was a royal official and since this boy's son is dying, I'm going to guess he took a chariot. I doubt that he walked. And he probably had that chariot ready to go as soon as Jesus would get in to take him, rush him to Capernaum. So they were really only a couple hours away. That becomes important later in the story. And I want you to notice, it doesn't say that the man came and politely asked Jesus if he would come and heal his son. See the word there? He begged. In fact, the word in the Greek gives a continuous meaning. He kept on begging Jesus. He didn't just come one time and say, hey, by the way, if you have a minute, would you come down with me to Capernaum? He kept on begging Jesus. Jesus, you got to come. Jesus, please come. Jesus, you've got to come quickly. My son is dying. Please come and heal him. Over and over and over. Now, notice the next verse. Jesus' reply to this man seems like an unexpected rebuke. He says, unless you see miraculous signs and wonders, you'll never believe. Hey, wait a minute. What are you? This guy's asking you for something and you're just going to kind of pass him off like that? Well, there is one indication here that Jesus wasn't talking to that man. Now, he was directing his words to him, but he was really targeting everybody else. Notice it says, unless you people see miraculous signs and wonders, you will never believe. The you there in the Greek is plural both times. So he's not speaking to this one individual about his spiritual condition. He's talking to him about everybody else. He knew what the Galileans were about. He knew that they were fascinated with him. He knew they were just fans looking for the next great display of divine power. So he says to them, through this one individual, you people will never believe unless you see some miraculous sign. Now it was a rebuke, I think, to the other Galileans, but to this individual it was a test. It was a test of his faith. He wanted to see if this man was easily dissuaded, like a fan would be. If he got his feelings hurt and would go away, that's not the sign of someone that has true faith. But I also think it was a commentary on the people of his day. Merrill Tenney observes, Jesus was weary of being solicited for an exhibition of his powers. And his brusque reply was a protest against the popular feeling toward him, meaning the larger group of people, not just that individual man. He did not want to be regarded as a worker of miracles or marvels while the message he presented was rejected. And that gets us right back to that distinction that Eidelman made. Are we following Jesus because he's our meal ticket? Are we following Jesus because of the spectacular things he does? And boy, I'm hoping he'll do it for me. Or are we believing the message that he presents? This idea of seeing is believing has always been the pragmatic philosophy of a lost world, even the religious world. We even have a saying in our culture, don't we? That guy's from Missouri. What's that mean? Show me, and then I'll believe. They even call Missouri the show me state. I wonder if Missouri wasn't inhabited by a bunch of ancient Galileans. You know, that's really true of a lot of people, not just from Missouri. Show me, and then I'll believe. It's reflected in the words in John 6:30. What miraculous sign will you give that we may see it and believe you? They wanted to see something. But Jesus was not pleased with a faith based on his miracles and not based on his word alone. It's more honoring to him to believe simply because he said it, not just because he gives some visible proof. Remember what happened, and I'm jumping way ahead in the story of the life of Jesus, but remember what happened after his death and resurrection. He appeared to 10 of the disciples in the upper room, and they were all excited, but one guy wasn't there, Thomas. And when Thomas gets back, and Jesus had already gone by then, the other 10 are all excited. Oh, Thomas, we saw Jesus. He was here. It was great. You missed it. And what did Thomas say? Unless I put my fingers in the holes, my hand in the where the spear went in his side, I'm not going to believe. What's he saying? Unless I see it, he even took it a step further, unless I touch it, I won't believe. So, Jesus I just marvel sometimes at God's sense of humor. It's throughout Scripture. Jesus comes back and he makes sure Thomas is there. And he goes right to Thomas, first thing. And I'm sure he just kind of stuck out his hands and says, "Here you go, Thomas. You said you needed to put your fingers in the hole. There they are. Go ahead. Here's that wound in my side. It's me. I'm real." To which Thomas does what anybody would do, falls to his feet and says, "My Lord and my God." But you know what Jesus said after that? In John 20:29, he says, "Because you have seen me, you believed. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet believe." That's true faith. It's not faith based on what we have seen. It's faith based on what we believe, even if we haven't seen it. See, when people get what they want, belief comes very easily. See somebody that's just witnessed a miracle, someone that they love, or maybe they themselves have been miraculously cured of an incurable disease. Oh, they believe. Something has happened to them totally unexpected that changes their life for the better. We believe. What happens when it doesn't turn out that way? That's when you discover if there's real faith. Now back to our story. Jesus says to the man, and he's actually speaking to the whole crowd, "Unless you see some miracle, you won't believe." And the man keeps begging. Verse 49, the royal official said, "Sir, come down before my child dies." You might wonder, what does he mean by "come down"? He was speaking here geographically. Now, Cana and Capernaum, the direction was actually more west to east. We tend to think of coming down as north to south, and we go up, we go from south to north. They were talking here about elevation. Cana was up in the hills, and Capernaum was at the Sea of Galilee, which is about 700 feet below sea level. So he's literally saying, come down the hill, come down the mountain to Capernaum, come with me. Here's the point. The man thought Jesus had to be there in order to heal the son. He probably figured that Jesus would have to physically touch him. There was kind of a catch involved here. And Jesus didn't give him what he wanted. You say, wait a minute. I've read the end of the story. I know the son gets healed. What do you mean? Well, listen to what the man said. "Jesus, come with me to Capernaum to heal my son." And Jesus said, "No, I'm not going to Capernaum." Now, he didn't say that in the text, but that's what he's implying. What he said was, "Go." The man said, "Come." He said, "Go." In fact, the phrase here is kind of like, "Off you go then." Carry on. Go about your business. It's almost a way of saying, leave me alone. But, he added, your son will live. Sometimes we're guilty of this. We want God to answer our prayers in a certain way. We want it to be done this way. And sometimes God says, no, that's not my way. I'm not going to do that here. Now, there were times when Jesus would touch someone and make them well. That's true. But in this instance, and again, I think it's because of where he was, the attitude of the people, but it was also very individual. This man's faith was being tested. Because he had a choice to make. This created a dilemma of faith, you might say. If he refused to return to Capernaum without taking Jesus with him, he would show that he did not trust or believe Jesus' word. If he kept on begging, if he kept on saying, "Jesus, come down, come down, come down," Jesus says, "I've already told you your son is okay." To keep begging him to come down to do it my way would show a lack of faith. On the other hand, if he followed Jesus' order, he'd be returning to the dying boy with no outward assurance that his son would recover. So he was forced to make a decision. Was he going to keep insisting on evidence to see in order to believe, or would he exercise faith without any tangible proof to encourage him? Now, verse 50 tells us the decision he made. The man took Jesus at his word and departed. This was the unmistakable response of faith. At that moment, his weak and faltering faith became obedient faith. It rose to a higher level. Without any sign, without any miraculous evidence, the man believed the word of Jesus and he went on his way. And that, folks, is faith. When God doesn't do things exactly the way I think it ought to be done, do we still believe? This man's answer was yes. And he left. Now, if we read the story too quickly, we might think that when it says that he departed, that he hopped in his chariot and rushed for home. I don't think so. Why? Because when he gets home and the servants come out and say, "Wow, your child's been healed. He's gotten better." The man said, "What time did this illness depart? What time did he get better?" And by the way, when it says that he recovered, when it says that he got better, the word there is for instantaneous. It wasn't a gradual getting better. All of a sudden, this boy went from being on death's door to being perfectly whole. And even the servants 18 miles away in Capernaum realized something amazing happened. Because when he said, "When did this happen?" they said, "About the seventh hour." We would say 1 o'clock in the afternoon, yesterday. Do you catch that? Yesterday. Now, if Jesus had spoken those words at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and he had hopped in his chariot and rode 2 hours to Capernaum, he'd have been there the same day. He waited until the next day to go home. Think about that. Jesus said, "Go on your way, carry on," and he did. Maybe he had some business to take care of there in Cana. I don't know. But he didn't rush home. He waited until the next day to go home. And again, I think that gives an evidence to the faith of this man. Well, it's been taken care of. Might as well get some things done around here that I need to do. I'll be home tomorrow and I'm sure he'll be fine. Again, that's faith. That is really taking Jesus' word for it. Now, as he gets home, verses 51 to 53 tell us that, again, his servants met him with the news, found out that it was the same exact time when Jesus had said to him, "Your son will live." And notice the last phrase in 53. "So he and all his household believed." Now, he didn't just say that he believed in Jesus' words. That was earlier. When you see, especially in the Gospel of John, someone believed, that means they believe in Jesus. We might say they got saved. This is a life-changing experience, and it was he and his whole household. Now, I want you to notice the progression of this man's faith. He began with crisis faith. He's about to lose his boy, and he had no other recourse but to go to God. Isn't that amazing how we do that sometimes? We have a need, and we try everything else, and when nothing else works, well, I guess I'll go to God. It's like the phrase, "When all else fails, follow the directions." Instructions, who needs those? 2 hours later, where are those instructions, right? He had a crisis faith. And when put to the test, His crisis faith became confident faith. He put his trust in what Jesus said. And there was peace in his heart, even enough to delay his trip home because he knew that his son was out of danger. On his way home, his confident faith became a confirmed faith because he saw the evidence of the work of God. His son had been completely healed, and it wasn't a coincidence because it was the exact hour that Jesus had spoken the words the day before. And then that confident, confirmed faith became a contagious faith because he shared it with his whole family. That's how faith grows. And we may be anywhere in that spectrum of where our faith is at any one time. But faith is not just something you have or you don't. Faith is something that grows. And sometimes it falters. Sometimes it gets weak and we've got to strengthen it. It's something alive that's a part of us. And he didn't have a whole lot of faith when he started, but he had a much stronger faith at the end. Now, in closing the account of this miracle, John writes in verse 54, this is the second miraculous sign that Jesus performed. If we were to stop there, there'd be a problem. We know the first one was at the wedding at Cana of Galilee, when he turned water into wine. But we're told that when he was in Jerusalem, he performed miraculous signs, and that's what got all the Galileans so excited in the first place. So how can you say this is the second one? Well, read the rest of the verse. Having come from Judea to Galilee. John is not saying this is the second miracle Jesus ever performed. He said it was the second of these selected signs in Galilee that Jesus was doing to reveal who he was. And just like the first one, it was in Cana. That's where he was when it happened. Interestingly, Jesus' first miracle there showed his power over time. He took water and turned it not to grape juice, but to already fermented wine. And he did it instantaneously. Here, he shows his power over space. He spoke the word in Cana, 18 miles away. His word was fulfilled in Capernaum. He is truly the God over time and space. These are no sleight of hand illusions. These are supernatural acts that could only be done in the power of Almighty God. Now, I think this is more than a story about a miracle, though. It's a story about one man who was challenged to move beyond fascination to faith. He was called out of his comfort zone and challenged to follow Jesus in a way that probably didn't feel right at the time. In the end, he proved to be a true follower and not just a fan. And it changed the lives of his entire family. And I agree with Eidelman's words. Many have made a decision to believe in Jesus without making a commitment to follow Jesus. The gospel allows for no such distinction. Biblical belief is more than mental assent or verbal acknowledgement. Many fans have repeated a prayer or raised their hand or walked forward at the end of a sermon and made a decision to believe, but there was never a commitment to follow. Jesus never offered such an option. He is looking for more than words of belief. He is looking to see how those words are lived out in your life. When we decide to believe in Jesus without making a commitment to follow him, we become nothing more than fans. My concern is that many of our churches in America have gone from being sanctuaries to becoming stadiums. And every week, all the fans come to the stadium where they cheer for Jesus, but they have no intention of truly following him. What about us? Are we fans of Jesus? Are we really followers? Are we fascinated with what we read in the Bible and what we hear people say? Or do we have true faith? And that's a decision that each one of us has to make for ourselves. As we close, turn in your hymnal to hymn number 425. Hymn number 425, Faith is the Victory that Overcomes the World. Do you have that kind of faith this day? If not, you can start. You can decide, I'm done with being a fan of Jesus. I want to be a follower. I want to follow Him regardless of where it takes me. Whether or not it goes the way I think it should go, we need to say to the Lord, where You lead, I will follow. That's what it means to be a true follower of Jesus. Let's stand together. We're just going to sing the first verse, hymn number 425.